But clearly the capitalist system is a problem. It leads to all kinds of outcomes that are damaging. And we see examples of that today, just in even the language you use and how we conceive of the problems of this economic crisis. It's all tied to this concept of the gross domestic product, which is falling, and therefore we're in recession, and we got to do something about that. But as people know, if you've gone into sustainable development literature and so forth, and these issues are all connected, and the more we emphasize production and producing more goods and services, the more ecological damage occurs and more social damage occurs and so forth. I was going to mention Ronald Wright's excellent book, A Short History of Progress, which I think is just a fantastic read into the nature of these kinds of problems. But we've conceived an economic system based on capitalism, and if anything, what's happened in the last year with this crisis, first in the United States and now rippling around the world in major and pretty scary ways, is clearly the market is not all as it's been cracked up to be, and the proponents of laissez-faire capitalism from Milton Friedman and others has, I think, now been largely discredited. But the question is, what is going to replace it? And clearly there's a need for, a strong need for public intervention, public oversight through our governments and so forth, and getting a handle and control. And a lot of it is just individual beliefs too do individuals have the right to just accumulate more and more and more? Is it right that Carlos Slim is the second richest man in the world and has wealth the equivalent to something like 40% of all Mexicans? I think that's immoral, and I think that even personally, on a personal level, I think that about billionaires and even multimillionaires, I just think it's unjust for people to amass so much and then to have so much power and control. So, but truthfully, our organization hasn't got a position on that, but we would certainly be in favor of a strong government role in regulating commerce, and most importantly, I think in ensuring there's a much more equitable distribution of the wealth that we do create in the country. And there's powerful data that's come out in the last few years about the growing gap between incomes and wealth. It just keeps going and going and going. The people at the top 10%, but really the top 1%, and even the top 0.1% are really driving that incredible spread. And we've got to get a handle on that. And I think more people are becoming aware of that. And it's a question of what is government really prepared to do? We would certainly support higher rates of taxation on higher income earners, lower rates of taxation on lower income earners. That'd be one way we could kind of close that gap. But how to address the fundamental flaws of capitalism, and if you've read the book, The Corporation, it's just a brilliant analysis of the, what's the word, sort of the out of control, monstrous nature of particularly the publicly traded corporation, and that ethic of must maximize shareholder value as the predominant driver of publicly traded corporations. That's a big mistake and a big problem we have to face. So, and that's a big rambling question, response to, I think, a pretty profound question.
Thank you. Well, Richard, well said.
Just one comment on that. You're good.
Thanks.
Yeah, I have a question. It's open to anybody, but I think it's related to capitalism and also just generally government involvement and I guess change from the grassroots up. Is that I think I actually have a friend that sort of had this idea. But that in general, to really make the change that is necessary in our world, and especially like in economic terms, it requires that every person themselves are able to make decisions for themselves that are sort of right for any number of reasons, environmentally or justice reasons, and that it's not something that there's no, you know, golden rule of how to act in a changing economy where people are trying to become more sustainable across the board. So how do you sort of empower like individuals to make changes as a group, but also in that it's a day-to-day individual decisions that are outside of a given sort of movement?
Well, I guess I would start first with saying that, you know, we all have a profound responsibility as individuals to, you know, protect the sacredness of Mother Earth and to walk lightly upon our mother, you know, in doing so, knowing that, you know, we're taking care of this beautiful gift for our children. however, you know, I'm always cautious when we talk about the power of the individual versus the power of the collective. You know, I find that environmentalists, conservationists, have their way, their perspective. And I get into it with a lot of different environmentalists and conservationists about this very topic. And, you know, I guess for me, one of the things that I commonly tell folks is that, you know, we have to create systematic change. There is a great amnesia that exists within the environmental movement in Canada. And we see that through a top-heavy focus, policy intervention, litigation utilizing the Canadian Environmental Regulatory Framework, and that's about it. We don't see any investment in community organizing, in expanding the base of political resistance to environmental, you know, issues that we face today. We don't see that bottom-up organizing framework happening. And so in that context, there's a lot of emphasis on relying on the consumer market again to rectify itself by messaging through glitzy PR campaigns like, you know, don't shop at Walmart, that end up being very narrow in their focus, because where is a mother, a single mother with 10 children, you know, on social assistance supposed to shop to provide them with entertainment, with diapers, with Enfalac, with everything else that they need to run a household? There's not a lot of options out there. And so, you know, one of the things that I commonly tell folks is not to get caught up on, you know, definitely conservation plays a big part. Individual contribution to, you know, our ecological footprint on Mother Earth. We have to be aware of that. But, you know, fundamentally the system is broken. We have got to change the system, and to do that we have got to establish a critical mass of citizens to build that political base of resistance so that, you know, we can create the systematic change that we need to happen. And relying on individual consumers to create that change within the current existing market, you know, I mean, maybe that might happen with Victoria's Secret's, you know, stopping making, you know, their magazines with old growth forests. But when we start getting into the oil and gas sector, consumers don't give a shit if it's destroying indigenous land. They need to get their kids to school. And so the demand doesn't drop, okay? The demand does not drop. You know, so it's a very complex area. So I always tell folks, you know, we have to conserve, for sure we have to take responsibility and do what we can within our means to walk lightly across Mother Earth, but fundamentally we have got to be organizing within a movement framework that is directly aimed at systematic change, because for the most part, if we change the laws to laws that, you know, force us to change anyway, then great, you know, it's going to happen. So, you know, it's a balance, with I think more of the emphasis needing to be on the systematic change piece.
Great. Anyone else?
Ed alluded to this when he spoke, but if I could do one thing in the education system, it would be to introduce sort of mandatory civics education for even the youngest children in a way that's appropriate for them. But I don't think it's there's never too young an age in my view to introduce that, because we've all been through the education systems that we've been through, and I think there are many, many problems with them. But I think they cultivate too much of an individualism kind of, you know, you need to get the training and get your literacy and your various math skills and science skills and then go out there and conquer the world kind of thing. I think we're really fundamentally very, very strongly social beings, and we need to understand how our interactions affect others. And then again, the, you know, free market capitalism that says if you look after your own interest, everything's going to be great. But obviously that's not the case. I can look after my own interest, but at the expense of Angeli or Ed or, you know, whatever. So I think from the youngest age, children need to be exposed to just discussion about what does it mean to be a human being, what are our obligations, what happens when you do something, how does it affect other people. I don't think there's anywhere near enough of that sort. Or people are massive people are graduating with. And then we plunge out into the world, like many young adults in this room, and we realize, well, wait a minute, there is something to be said about community. Look, this isn't right, this doesn't feel right for me. What's going on? It conflicts with everything I've been exposed to through the education system. So if I could wave one thing to change the education system and bring in more, much more civics education for children and for youth.
Yeah. And just to compliment what Clayton and Rob have said, I don't think you can overstate the importance of, to paraphrase that old saying, living the change you want to see. Because it sometimes can be daunting, you know, to talk about, you know, changing, you know, bringing the oil, the military-industrial complex to its knees, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not sure I could get up every morning facing that challenge, but if I can sort of recycle my newspapers, let my kids see that, and, you know, can then talk about their kids doing that, too, then I think that they can't overstate the importance of that, because that'll have the ripple effect. And you know, just think about now, like the paradigm shift that has happened in our society with regards to smoking. You know, if this was like, you know, 15, 20 years ago, half of you would be smoking in this room right now. And now if somebody lights a cigarette, you know, someone would probably call the cops, you know. So that I'm sure when those people started that movement, you know, felt that they were facing those kinds of, you know, massive, you know, obstacles. And look how far that movement has come in such a short period of time. So I think it's important to sort of like keep our own spirits up and to always have that positive, you know, approach to these, you know, challenges that we're facing every day.
Thank you. I just have one thing to add, which is something that Clayton told me, so maybe he could add it. But I think a while back, but I think I was talking to him about how it just seems impossible to, you know, get everyone to see the point of view that to me seems so obvious and to most of the people I spend a lot of time with seems so obvious, but that it just doesn't seem to be happening on a broader scale. And you remember, I think you've told us a bunch of times, but that Clayton was saying that it's not every single person that you meet. Like, I'm sure many people have been in situations where you're like, this person is just making me crazy, and I'm never going to get them to change their mind, and they're just stuck in this kind of stuck in this place where this is just where they're coming from, and that's where they're staying, and that I just shouldn't waste my time with them, and because I don't need that person, you know. There's a large community that's building, and that we don't need every single person to be part of that in order to be able to change the system as a whole. To paraphrase crazy guys like James Clayton. But I think that can be something to hold on to and be a little bit inspired by when it's feeling a bit daunting, which it can at times.
So thanks very much, first, for the presentation. I very much enjoyed them. One common theme that I saw throughout pretty much all four of the presentations was the theme of education and the fact that some of the message does not seem to be getting out to the youth, especially, or to people in general, about what the issues are. And so Rob mentioned it very, very explicitly, and the others mentioned either alluded to it or mentioned it as well. And I'm wondering, what actions right now do you see being taken in our movement itself surrounding education, and what actions should be taken, but there is a lack on that specific issue?
One second.
I didn't quite understand the question.
Clarify the question.
Okay, the movement itself, we think education is important, getting people to understand what the issues are. In your organizations, do you have an education branch? Do you have other partner organizations which have specific education components? And is that something that the movement should take up? Is that something we should lobby governments to improve in schools? That's the more specific question that I have.
I'll start off on that. And it's because Kairos is all about education. We have a committee that's the Animation Education Committee that looks after, you know, resources. And what we focus on is the participatory style education. So, you know, the old adage that if we stand here and talk to you just like this, you'll go away remembering 10% of the stuff we said. But if we somehow engage in activities and exercises that, you know, involve, you know, different senses, you know, if you actually get to stand up and participate in an exercise, then you'll go away with a greater percentage of information. And so what Kairos starts to do is when we're tackling issues like Indigenous rights, or we're tackling issues like, you know, ecological justice, corporate social responsibility, anti-poverty, we try to, you know, complement expert styles, like, you know, having someone who knows about the issues talk about them. We try to complement that with participatory techniques and methodology as well. And we'll try to tailor those specific resources to our groups. So, you know, Kairos regularly puts out resources that deal with, you know, different issues. And I actually have a sample here that I can show handily. This is something that we produced recently called In Peace and Friendship. And it's a resource that looks at the history of the relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in Canada. And it's broken up into 5 sessions that you can do over a weekend, for example, or, you know, once a week, and they're 2.5-3 hour sessions. And they all have exercises, and they all have readings, and they all have, you know, the public education participatory approach. The idea being that, you know, if we can get people involved in these kind of things, they'll learn more about the history, and they'll learn more than if I was just going to stand up here and talk to you about the history of the relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. Then when you have that base of people who have that information and have that understanding, when it comes time to for advocacy and action, then you've got that pool of people that you can work with. So that's you know, basically what we're all about. We have our people who do the research and, you know, who come up with policies and positions, but we also have the people whose job it is then to bring those policies and positions to the grassroots.
Yeah, I guess we have a couple of different things. You know, the Indigenous Environmental Network, as Anjali mentioned, is a founding member of the Energy Action Coalition in the United States, which has an initiative called the Campus Climate Challenge, which is working in like 5,000 universities to try and, you know, shift universities to clean energy fuel sources, right down to small things like, you know, getting universities to transition to fluorescent bulbs. We've taken our Campus Climate Challenge program and made it rather unique in terms of the fact that we have a tribal campus climate organizer that works in about 24 tribal universities and colleges across the United States. And we have a whole environmental justice lens through our Tribal Campus Climate Challenge, which, you know, is still focused on getting, you know, Native-run colleges and universities to transition to renewable energy sources to, you know, be as zero carbon as possible, to lower their emissions, but also to, you know, do some movement building on those campuses and link that student body to support environmental justice struggles that are going on in Indian country with the fossil fuel sector. And so there's a whole political education aspect that's really based in popular education approaches, which is, you know, a similar approach that Ed and the folks at Kairos utilize, which is all about, you know, participatory education and, you know, and a lot more about retention. And so, and then we also, through our organizing and our various campaigns, we utilize a model of base building called action camps. And so we bring together community activists, students, different folks together, you know, into the space, usually for 3 to 5 day time frames, where we develop, you know, popular education curriculum to politicize that particular group on a particular issue and to mobilize them into action, you know, on say, the tar sands. And so that's another aspect of education that we do. And then as campaigners, we speak at a lot of different events like this. Like I mentioned, I've spoke at many, many, many universities over the last couple of years on the tar sands issue, and will continue to do so, because I think that the student population is just so, let's just say, they're not as jaded as other groups, you know, and can definitely be called to action, I think, on some of these key issues we face a lot quicker. You know, than some of the other folks in this great place called Canada.
Teamwork.
Very briefly, I wanted to mention the matter of framing, the art of framing an issue in a way that people who might not be listening otherwise will begin to connect to it. And we were twigged onto this. It was recommended to us that we get hold of a book called Don't Think of an Elephant by a guy named George Lakoff, who's an expert linguist in the United States, and he's been a high-level advisor to the Democratic Party for a number of years, and I think Barack Obama has drawn fairly heavily on some of what Lakoff and his colleagues have attempted to do. But the whole Lakoff as a linguist, his whole interest is really around how words and language can be used effectively or not effectively to connect to people who don't see the world through the same set of lens, you know. So for the work that we do, and I think this is very important for those who are working on social change, that we appreciate that the words and language we use might be comfortable for us, but may not be comfortable at all for the people that we're trying to win over. So be very conscious about that and be more skilled in the use of language. So for us, in tackling poverty, one of the big challenges is the whole issue of taxation. Will governments have sufficient fiscal capacity to invest in areas of critical social need? With a government like the Harper government, which has a strongly anti-tax ideology, but they and the conservative, small-c conservative philosophy has been very successful in convincing the public that the so-called tax burden and the need for tax relief, it appears over and over and over in the federal budget, those words. And for the most part, Canadians support that. Polls show that Canadians want lower taxes. But there's a strong correlation between taxation and the quality of life we enjoy. There's a powerful study was done by two University of Toronto economists looking at, or tax law specialists, looking at the social and economic performance of higher tax countries like the Nordic countries and lower tax countries like Canada and the UK. And they found that the higher tax countries have, on balance, much stronger social and economic performance, hopefully also environmental, than the lower tax countries. And that citizens report higher quality of life, greater satisfaction with their lives, even though they're paying, in some cases, much higher levels of taxation. So how do we reframe the discussion around taxation in a way that connects to people's values? And so we're talking about that, and we think that the way to do it is to talk more about the services that we enjoy as a result of the taxes we pay. And most Canadians say, yeah, you're right. Our health care, you know, from sidewalks to infrastructure to whatever, that all comes from the taxation we are willing to put in. But there's a big, big challenge there for us to address that from a framing point of view. So I just wanted to mention, I think it's an area that within social change movements we can become much more cognizant of.
Can I just add a couple of things? I mostly work with universities and colleges, like I said before, and one of the things that we try to do is help students integrate the kind of activism they want to do into their curriculum. So So directly getting course credit, and this has happened at many campuses across the country, and if you happen to be interested in that, I'd be happy to talk to you about that. And in addition, I think there's an issue with curricula. I've done some workshops with high school students on, for example, the history of racism in Canada. And I remember my high school history classes. I'm actually in the States for high school, but there certainly was, from my experience of doing these workshops with high school students and high school teachers in Canada, that most of the teachers actually haven't heard of some of the things that we're talking about. And we were running a high school conference here in Ottawa just last Friday, and I said, you know, who's heard of Afrophil? And I don't know what the response would be in this room. I assume it would be higher than there. But in that case, there was one teacher who had heard of it, and not a single one of the students or the other dozen or so teachers there. And so I think that there's a big challenge with curricula and the way we want to, you know, positively present things, but where we miss out on large pieces of our history. There's a question at the back first, and then I'll get you.
Comments, if I may. My name is Kevin Dooley. I'm just a global kind of dog's practice activist for decades. Thanks for the talk. It's very good. I'm just looking through the program. And I have a question. I'm trying to get into a framework, but what I said is missing. Void in absence of something organized, but just as I'm looking at the picture here, in this sentence, there's a great sense of being historical here. Like, you know, it's sense of struggle. It's not just new, and it's not all just geared into the latest economic crisis or sort of the entire sense. It's been going on for decades. The whole country's been struggling. When you look at the movements that are in the country, and we're talking about standard, because I'm an emperor of Ireland, and I've seen Ireland was called down the tubes, as a movement, so as it fastened itself into a corporate economy, the country was just about destroyed as a result of government following that corporate program. Anybody who had any common sense could see it. So we for decades in our America, locked into a way of thinking. You mentioned there's no immigrant sectors here. Well, I think that I'm on here. You know, I've been here over 30 years, it's still in an immigrant mentality. I've lived and worked in our country. The bottom line is easy. And we're being reduced to that. So organizing for justice is fine. The struggle is very good. I looked at the program. The missing component in it here is trying to reach out to the labor. The nuts and bolts of struggle and the nuts and bolts of organization. When it comes down to people in their everyday life, and in the most collect areas is the workplace. Not students, they don't end up in workplaces. Everything else is transition. Workplace is not. And the communities we live in, houses and neighborhoods, are not. Like the European collaboration, they're not going to live there. So I think, when there's any sense of organizing, see, there is a union organizing part of it, so it's very minimal. And the minimal connection we have here is that in the labor movement, it's not just in the labor movement in Canada, and then to look at the struggles going on outside, like Shabazz and the stuff going on in South Africa, the other parts of the world, how it's moving. And it's moving in mass on the ground. And often it takes up its own momentum. So I think when you're organizing parties, you're a catalyst, you're ahead of it. You know, I'm going to attend some of the workshops, and I've had experience in this sort of stuff over decades. But we're ahead of the way, but we have to understand some of the missing components on a huge one, in my opinion. And the labor movement is a difficult one. It's lost its head. But fundamentally, it's one of the most democratic, cognitive, and fighting organization we have in North America. And it showed itself in the election of Obama. The elections came without from the labor movement, how they know. And to become in this country, we can reach into brothers and sisters in every workplace, back into the labor movement. I think should be a focus for our community, our justice. Because that's where it is. That's where historic tradition and historic development. Every union in this country, and anybody over any age knows that they crack heads, blood, sweat, and tears within the building. So we have to sense, number one, the framework is the question of history. It's kind of absent here. I'd like to see more of it in here. And the question of building links to the labor movement. Do you see that as important?
Okay, so do people want to respond?
Yeah, I don't know if you caught the end of my presentation. We only had 10 minutes to talk tonight. I'll just put that out. But I will assure you that, at least from the perspective of the Indigenous Environmental Network, labor has always been a strong ally, and very tricky as well, you know. I think when we're looking at the issue of the tar sands, no other sector, aside from frontline communities, has been impacted more than the manufacturing sector of Canada. You know, the economic focus has shifted, as we all know, we've seen it in the media, from Ontario, which has historically been an economic powerhouse with its manufacturing sector, and the shift has focused now to Calgary. You know, because of the tar sands industry, because of the strong petrodollar, and Ontario has been deemed a have-not province. You know, I spoke at the Canadian Labour Congress this year on the topic of green jobs. And, you know, for us, a big component to environmental justice, a big component to organizing in a social movement's framework, is trying to facilitate and foster solidarity between different struggles, whether it's the student movement, the labor movement, the Indigenous rights movement, and other social movements as well, so that we can foster in that systematic change on common struggles that we all face. And I think when we put things in the context of global climate change and the threat that you know, poses not just to Indigenous communities, but also to the high-emitting labor sectors like the steel workers and the auto worker industries and other high-emitting industries that are going to be impacted by climate policy that, mark my words, is coming down the tubes. Okay? It's coming. There is a fundamentally important link there that needs to be fostered, a relationship that needs to be connected in terms of directly between the labor movement and Indigenous struggle. Because in Canada, we have a really unique population demographic. We've got 30 million people, 1.8 million Indigenous peoples, and 70% of those 1.8 million Indigenous peoples are under the age of 30. So by the year 2016, we're going to have one out of every four Canadian worker is going to be a native person, Inuit, Métis, non-status, or status Indian, okay, which is a tremendous and profound shift of economic power, of social and political power, to a population that has otherwise been marginalized and forgotten, especially in this last federal election. So let me assure you that, at least from our perspective, we see the value and the power in uniting with labor, with our Indigenous land rights struggle, because And we know that labor understands the importance of investing in the Indigenous rights struggle, because a quarter of the workers in this country will be native within the next decade, because we'll face a crisis with our labor market. The baby boomers, everybody's retiring, you know, and nobody's having kids except for native people and new immigrants. So, you know, I'm there. I feel you.
I'm having kids too, by the way.
Oh.
But I think it's important too that we talk about struggle. I mean, the word has come up before, and we, you know, sometimes we forget that we're struggling against something. And Rob mentioned having to deal one of the problems and challenges in his work is dealing with myths and misconceptions about, you know, people who live in poverty. And, you know, Clayton can talk about, you know, the myths and misconceptions around Indigenous people as well. I think it's interesting that there are also myths and misconceptions around labor and unions. I mean, look at the crisis facing the auto industry now, and what do you keep hearing reported? Well, you know, they're hoping that they'll let the industry crash so that they can, you know, rebuild, and what do they talk about? You know, undermining the unions at the, you know, achievements to date. So, you know, as if that's the root of the problem. And, you know, I just want to emphasize how much support that the Kairos is, and the churches that form Kairos have received from the unions, because you have there a body, a pool of people who understand rights and justice issues. because that's why they gather into a union, because they know how important it is to join together to fight for causes. So as, you know, people who are working and fighting for social justice, it just makes common sense to align ourselves with those organizations and individuals who have that kind of experience.
Okay, great. We have at least one, I have four questions, and we have about 15 minutes. So first we have a woman's voice.
Facing, like many of our indigenous communities across this country, Industry manipulates government, whether it's provincial or federal, to target these communities and to package up economic development incentives to get them to buy into these quick fix solutions. And, you know, I mean, the Dominion, you know, a special issue this year talks about mining. You know, 80% of the mining projects represented in the world stock markets are from Canadian companies. So it's just a little statistic for you all to consider. I think that for big ENGOs, you have to be careful how you engage local communities. I mean, Greenpeace's anti-fur campaign was a nightmare, but they still pay for it to this day. I think there are some fundamental, you know, very simplistic, easy principles to understand around bottom-up grassroots organizing. I think that the National Sierra Club has a lot to learn from the Prairie Chapter. You know, Lindsay Telfer's group, they're doing some spectacular work, political base building in rural urban communities that are impacted by the tar sands, as well as working with First Nations. You know, Sierra Youth Coalition has a spectacular anti-oppression policy that has some pretty good principles in there that I think provide mechanisms on how to engage communities in an accountable and transparent way. But just to parachute in and try and drop down a prepackaged national campaign that says, hey, we're going to do this national policy intervention in this litigation, jump on board, without providing local capacity first and foremost and asking communities what their needs are, how do they want to address the situation, approaching it in that way, I find, typically, you're going to find a lot of resistance. There's going to be a whole lot of traditional people that have fished in that lake in both of those communities for time immemorial that are pissed off about what's going on. I know for a lot of First Nations communities, there are significant governance issues as a result of this failed colonial Indian Act governance system that's been imposed on our people. There's no separation of powers in chief and council. So the opportunity for corruption is great. You know, and the federal government sure as heck doesn't meet its trust obligation and provide the capacity dollars for communities to negotiate fair and equitable agreements with these big multi-million dollar mining companies. And so in that context, you know, it's very complex, and I urge caution of any kind of top-bottom approach. And, you know, and I think that, you know, I think that there is a shift in the mainstream environmental movement. They're beginning to understand, Sierra Club included, the importance of community organizing, of political base building, of expanding that base of political support. Because I think one thing that happens is a lot of organizations will just try and meet the right to prior informed consent, but consult with elected leadership, and that's it. And they don't take into consideration full and meaningful participation of all the stakeholders in those communities, traditional people, spiritual leaders, women, children, elders. You know, because the tribal council or the First Nations government or whatever the group that's making the decisions might not be doing that themselves. And not because they necessarily don't want to, but it might be a capacity issue. So it's a very, very complex situation that you can be facing. And I think there are a lot of organizations out there, IEN included, that know how to do base building work, that know how to do community organizing. You know, I definitely encourage you to talk to the folks over at Mining Watch Canada. You know, Jamie's a great guy. I think he can really give you a lot of good advice on how not to step any toes with your emerging work around those particular mining issues.
If I could just clap back your microphone.
Sure. Yeah.
I've been organizing with Mining Watch Canada and a number of other groups, and we're very aware not wanting to. I don't know if I can hear my question, but we're very aware of not wanting to step on anybody's toes and not wanting to go in with a top-down approach. It's just a matter of being on the ground and knowing people on the ground across Canada and having those connections that's sometimes challenging, the networking aspect of it, I guess. And obviously, consultation is a problem. I mean, the government has gone in, done consultation, quote-unquote, and obviously they met with, I mean, whoever that said, yeah, sure, you know, please bring this project to none of us, we want the job.
Okay, great. We're running out of time, so what I'm going to do is ask, I'm going to go in order of the questions, and then get the questions and have the speakers say the last responses. So, gentleman in the back is first.
Yeah.
Deinstitutionalizing this, because if the problem in part is the history of Western industrial capitalism, for example, that's vested and crystallized in the Canadian state. To abstract away from that history and to engage with that state, maybe it's a different matter of public policy, and maybe we can elect another governor, maybe we can lobby a governor, seems to me to be a real denial of state power. And the only way I can rationalize it is, again, by coming back to, well, an industrial complex has to perpetuate itself. So every few months, and the labor movement included, which I have more of a tie to, comes up with campaigns and prints out lots of glossy paper. No, then who's up the next one? Campaign 2000. If I'm not mistaken, the 2000 stood for the year that poverty was supposed to be eradicated when it was first come up with by some politicians in 1989. And maybe that's going to change the name. Like campaign 2010.
We're going to get kicked out of here in 6 minutes. I'm sorry. There's one other question. Okay, that's a lot, and seriously, they're going to lock us in if we're not out by 9. So, speakers, do you have like, thought that you can have like 15 seconds each? 20.
For the uranium mining, how do we, we had a bunch of, Mireille and Jack LaPointe over at our conference last week at Defenders of the Land in Winnipeg from RDOC. Straight up, nonviolent direct action. You know, and this goes for all strategies. You know, mobilizing demos and all of that are great. But bottom line, if we're going to really get sophisticated and try to stop this economic machinery that's, you know, hurting us all, we have got to engage in much more highly sophisticated nonviolent forms of direct action. And that means getting right in the way of these machines. You know, that means invoking the police state and all of that. You know, our organization as a policy does support nonviolent direct action as a strategy. And I think that, you know, bottom line is if you stop a bunch of trucks from going into a forestry site or a bunch of drill rigs from going into uranium drilling site, that's going to stop the money. Okay? And that's going to get the government's attention like that. It's also going to bring a lot down on you, but, you know, I think that it comes down to being highly sophisticated about that, you know, and having the right supports in place for, you know, the legal team, the jail team. There's different mechanisms to that. We can talk about it offline. I'd be more than happy to talk about how we approach nonviolent direct action. Nonprofit industrial complex, yeah, I mean, it's an issue. When you have foundations that get their money from the investments in the same Fortune 500 companies that are causing all the problems in the first place, and they only get a little percentage of that, and these same companies are investing billions and lobbying the same politicians on the Hill, it's a disproportionate playing field. And in that context, we have got to continue to do those interventions. They're very important. However, we've also got to focus on building movement, establishing a political base of resistance that is all about getting people involved and politicized to complement and inform and make accountable those policy interventions that are happening on the Hill here in Ottawa or in Washington, D.C. or in the United Nations or wherever.
Just quickly. Watch your hand. I think that just, I don't have time to touch on all of them, but I wanted to touch on the uranium comment and how do we get 100,000 people on Parliament Hill or in the streets. And I think that we don't have the kind of resources that the media have, that the government has to generate that kind of publicity, but I think that one way to start at least getting bigger numbers than we have right now is to start working together. And that's going to require prioritizing. So we're not all going to be able to all get together and all focus on one issue, or all the issues. So I think that, you know, one way that we can address that is by meeting more together. Instead of, I'm always surprised at how many people there are, how many organizations there are, how many different issues are being addressed.
somehow we need to start breaking down those silos and working more together as a larger group, and perhaps that way we can sort of generate the kind of numbers that will affect some real change.
So I don't know tons of them. I think the people who ask the questions actually have much more experience than I do. But I think that one thing in terms of becoming more effective has been taking this anti-oppressive approach, and I think that that is a start to being able to bring people together and being able to get more and more people on the same page as far as in the streets or whatever it is that the goal is. And that's made a big difference in what we're doing at SYC. And I guess the last point to put out there is that I know there's some quote, I can never remember quotations properly, but about keeping it fun, keeping the revolution fun, make the revolution party. And I think that we do a lot of talking and a lot of dialogue, and that the things that get people in the streets are parties. So that just to keep the optimism flowing. Okay. I want to thank the speakers, Emily, Ed, Rob, Tracy, and Dave. I'm excited for the conference. You guys excited? This is amazing. It's a tremendous way to kick it off, and we'll see you the rest of the weekend. Have a good night.